I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Maria Jose Rodriguez Cadiz. She's executive director of the Solace Crisis Treatment Center. And I'd like to welcome Susan Simons, who is here working with Solace on their upcoming event, Buy the Book, which is happening on Tuesday, December 2nd. That's Giving Tuesday, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. Welcome, everybody, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte, for having us back.
So tell us, Maria Jose, what is Solace all about? It used to once be called the Rape Crisis Treatment Center. Now it's Solace Crisis Treatment Center. What goes on there?
Correct. And, you know, a lot of people know us already with our new identity, with our new name. But just in case, I'll explain what our mission is. Most people do recognize Solace as the regional sexual assault service provider. And they also know that since we changed the name, we have been able to treat also individuals and their families who have been overwhelmed by other types of traumas.
And so there's all kinds of traumas and all kinds of post-traumatic stress going on here, unfortunately, in northern New Mexico.
Yeah, and actually, I was able to find a little research of the most current information, and what I learned that is the most current is that the lifetime prevalence of, first of all, of sexual assault in New Mexico it still is one in every four women and one in every 20 men. Part of the good news is that Solace, as well as any other one of our sexual assault service providers in our state, are finally able to help a lot more men than those of us that have been here in the business for over 12 years have seen with our own eyes before. So that, of course, is good news. And in terms of PTSD, since we were talking about it, Mary Charlotte, the prevalence of PTSD is 1 in 10 women and 1 in 20 men.
What are the types of things besides sexual assault that people are traumatized about?
Well, the people that come through our doors, through Solace Crisis Treatment Center, can come from a series of diverse tragedies. It could be that they have themselves known somebody who has been the victim of a violent crime, or that they have witnessed themselves a crime. It also could be, aside from the criminal justice system and being victims of crimes, that maybe they are first responders. So they are in the face of trauma day in and day out in their lives, and they can be suffering for what's called vicarious trauma or secondary trauma. Also, people that come through our doors may be here because they have recently received a chronic health diagnosis that kind of turns their life upside down. Or people who have been part of a horrendous accident and also their lives are a little bit in chaos. Or what's really, really often, Mary Charlotte, is that people may come with an accumulative number of traumatic events, some of them more minor, but maybe there is one, a final one, that might just be a little too much to cope with. So it's not rare that we treat, assess and treat people that might actually suffer for a lot of what we call co-occurring disorders.
Sometimes we call that death by a thousand paper cuts.
There you go.
You said something a moment ago, vicarious trauma, was that the term?
Yeah, it's kind of like a more technical term, and I appreciate that you're bringing me back to maybe make that more digestible for everybody. Vicarious trauma is the concept that is utilized by professionals when they're trying to explain that if you are a police person or a firefighter or a veteran being deployed to war, any one of those first responders, for instance, typically in the line of duty are going to be exposed to other people's hurt, other people's traumas, you know. And so that exposure can actually generate symptoms of anxiety or stress-related disorders in those first responders.
So talk talk a little bit about what women are going through and what men are going through here in New Mexico. You said you're serving the male population more than you used to. Obviously, rape crisis centers came up in the 60s and 70s to respond to a need, which is that there were so many women, and unfortunately still are, mm-hmm. who are sexually assaulted, who are not reporting their assaults. There was a Twitter thing going on recently. There's a hashtag called Raped and Never Reported. I mean, this is still happening, but there's much more reporting and much more treatment than there used to be for women. Talk for a moment about men. This is a group of people whose traumas and assaults and truths may not be told as much as they need to be.
Right. And also, basically men have been witnessing for years, for decades, women paving the road of how to reach out for help and how to cope with the stigma of, you know, having been raped and having to say so, to report, and to oftentimes being sometimes even more re-victimized by the judicial system. So for decades, women have been doing so thanks to the help of men and women that were involved during decades in our history and doing that kind of work, putting the name rape out in the spoken. And men now have witnessed that. They have seen that as hard as it is, there is also healing that comes afterwards. And women are resilient, and we are resilient, and we are in the world no matter what kind of tragedies have happened to us. They also, men now, have given us a lot of input. Here at the Solace Crisis Treatment Center, one of the main reasons why we decided that the name Rape at the Door wasn't really facilitating any matters was that men were coming through our doors, referred, let's say, by some health providers, and when they came to us and they walked our path here to our front door and they saw the name Rape at the Door, they told us that there was no way they were going to be able to stay in and get treatment. They knew they needed the help. They had amounted courage to come in, but the sole fact and view of the name Rape at the Door was just not going to be okay for them. It was a lot more difficult for men to walk in here than it was for women. And I think because stigma doesn't work the same for men that it does to women. So with that kind of input from their part, much more so, we were very engaged in the process of changing the name. But also, it is a national trend. Most rape crisis centers, not only in Santa Fe or in New Mexico or in the nation, are now called rape crisis centers. The practice is that you want to have a name that allows for people to embrace where they're going, not where they're coming from. They might be coming from rape and from crisis, but they're going to a different place. They're going to a place of healing, of change, of connectedness, of peace, of calmness.
It's kind of like the distinction that sometimes people make between the word victim and the word survivor.
Correct. Which is something that it needs to be left to the individual. The outside person cannot be the one calling somebody a victim or a survivor. Granted, in the criminal justice system, we talk about victims, right? And you will hear even us, service providers, referring to people who have been victimized more as a victim than a survivor if they're going through the criminal justice system is part of the language. We still leave it up to the individual to tell us where they're at, because that is a self-reflection, how much you are able to tell you are surviving an event is only up to you. You are the best thermometer to that.
So when people come in with whatever their trauma or issue or problem is, they then can get therapy of various kinds at the center?
Absolutely. Well, not therapies of various kinds. Thank you for saying that. We actually are good at one thing and at one thing only. We are good at assessing anybody of all those traumatic events that I described to you before or named to you before. We can assess everyone. We might be able to treat some, because the one thing that we do really well is stabilize anxiety and stress-related disorders. So if people need long-term treatment, upon the assessment that we do, that will be a finding, we will refer them to a long-term treatment facility. But if what they need is to become stable and to have those PTSD symptoms or those anxiety and stress-related disorder symptoms stabilized, we can do so regardless of the ability to pay, with no waiting list, and in a matter of 2 to 12 sessions.
Now, there's also an educational piece of what the center does.
Absolutely. We are lucky to have one entire department dedicated to do outreach. And outreach has changed drastically from those decades that you were mentioning before, you know, the beginning of the fight against sexual violence to today's days. We used to do a lot more education. Basically, back in the days, our activists and our volunteers and our professionals engaged in that conversation did a lot of education, and it's because of them that we were able to do things like going to the legislature and change laws so laws can constantly reflect better the needs of the community. Today's days, the outreach efforts are led by important initiatives that come from entities such as the Department of Health, CDC, and they are focused on what's called primary prevention. And the difference between primary prevention and education is that education gives people information about a particular matter. Primary prevention is focused on changing behaviors.
What does that actually look like in real life?
In real life, changing behaviors or first services and programs that are focused on changing behaviors are going to follow a particular set of standards. There are like 10 different standards that might make a program or a service or a curriculum suitable for qualify as primary prevention. And one of the most important things is that the right teachings and those observe the principles have the right doses. Typically, in order for anything to have the potential of changing behavior, has to have the necessary amount of exposure and the necessary dosage. So any program that used to go back in the days to the schools and it was sort of like a one-time exposure will never qualify as a primary prevention initiative because it needs to be a lot more extended and exposed than that.
Do you have data about how well these prevention programs work?
We have it, yeah, and that's why some of these practices that actually all of these practices that are led by initiatives from CDC and Department of Health have what is called research behind them, and that's what we say when we refer to evidence-based practices, meaning that what has been done because it reflects the same practice of something that has been studied and has scientific data behind it. So typically, these programs are going to start in schools. They're going to start really early, and they're going to be part of the curriculum and the life of the students for long periods of time. And they can do studies in terms of if there has been any behavioral modification from the beliefs that they measure at the beginning on the students before they were exposed to the programs and the beliefs that they might have now after the programs, since obviously beliefs are always behind behaviors. And how we act upon what we believe. So they have several mechanisms to measure the change.
One of the things that I always think about is, I mean, we talk about multiculturalism and cultural differences, and one of the biggest cultural differences from one group to the next is the role of men and women. And it seems to me, but correct me if I'm wrong on this, that the more inequality you have, the more problems there are with just the problems that we're talking about, assault and rape and things like that. Is that true?
That is so true. That is actually what you just named, Mary Charlotte, is actually at the core of any strong initiative of primary prevention. There is no potential of violence if there aren't, to start with, signs of oppression and discrimination. Basically, I'll see if I can put this in a more colloquial way. If I think I'm better than you, if I think that you don't deserve the same that I do, and somehow I live with that belief, there is more potential for me to either dismiss you to all the way in the spectrum of to cause you harm. It's a lot easier to cause harm when we think that we are bigger and better and more off than somebody else. And that there is where gender violence resides, is the oppression and discrimination that is being part of societies and continue being today's day between men and women, for instance. But it also explains why other communities are still those who suffer the most. I'll tell you, one community that suffers the most about sexual violence is actually our LGBTIQ community. And a lot of our practices now have to reflect mechanisms to bring down those barriers, to create more accessibility for members of that particular community in our community, and to be so sure that we know how to serve them well without making assumptions. But that is exactly what it is. Oppression and discrimination is the means that resides underneath violence and sustains violence.
And the way you put it, I mean, this would apply to a fifth grade class, and it applies to two countries that start fighting each other. I mean, macro, micro, it's the very similar dynamics.
Correct.
So do you work with the issue of human trafficking? Do you have people coming to the center who've been trafficked?
We have an incredible task force in our community that helps us, different entities, to network around that issue, because one of the things that still is a myth is to think or believe that human trafficking is kind of an exotic thing that happens away, far away distances from us, right? We think it's something that happens in other countries. We think it's something that happens only internationally. But the definition by law of human trafficking doesn't correspond to that. Human trafficking can happen right here in Santa Fe, by virtue of having, for instance, a runaway youth who is at the moment experiencing homelessness and is befriended by somebody with the presumption or the excuse of, you know, belonging, come with us, we're like you, we know what you've gone through, we know why you're running away. And then through that kind of friendship and even quote-unquote love, They become part of a network, and the first day they make it a request of something that is kind of weird and strange, but they do it. After a longer period of time, they might be having to prostitute themselves to even get food or clothes on. So they become slaves, and that is happening in the majority of the communities in this nation and, of course, internationally, but it doesn't require to move somebody from place to place. It is only that oftentimes that is the case. But as soon as you have a person and you're forcing them against their will or manipulating them to do something against their will, such as embrace or engage into sexual acts, it can constitute human trafficking. There are two or three parameters that make a case of human trafficking, and for or coercion, and being able to benefit financially from it are pretty much the core of it. You don't have to move people around.
Do you yourself, Maria Jose, experience vicarious trauma dealing with this all the time, day after day, year after year?
Yeah, I would say that I have my own mechanisms that I need to keep up really. I have to be very disciplined to do so if I don't want to have my own times in life where I'll tell you how that feels. First of all, you are a little more moody, or you can be a little more unstable emotionally and you don't know why. Second, your patterns of either sleep or eating can all of a sudden not be in tune with what you think you normally do. Three, you can just, for no good reason, maybe cry more often than you normally do, or react in a way in front of a particular scenario with a lot more emotion that you would have expected out of yourself. All of the above I had, I think, experience in 12 to 14 years of being in this field, and it's obviously a matter always of self-managing and self-recognizing and self-managing those symptoms so they will not create a severe problem to your personal life, or that you can become not the asset that you need to be professionally for somebody that really needs you. When we serve people, we have to serve them. I put it this way: my client today has to have everything from me, no matter what I came from doing yesterday with another client. I have to be new and fresh and solid and robust for that person. And it takes a lot of self-tuning. It takes therapy. It takes doing the things that you love in life, you know, being out with your dogs or walking or reading or having fun or whatever your hobbies are. It takes to have, you know, in my case, I will say a lot of regularity, taking care of myself. If it is that I need a good diet or that I need to take myself to the gym regularly, what really, really matters, Mary Charlotte, is to be disciplined and having what I would say needs to be a daily regular way of self-care that doesn't wait for when you are, like, very off. It does it right. Every day. Every day I am committed to do two or three things that I know keep me really solid. So I can say that one particular event, one particular tragedy may not affect me tremendously, but if I am disciplined in having that daily routine, I know I am going to combat vicarious trauma tremendously.
We're talking to Maria Jose Rodriguez Cadiz of the Solace Crisis Treatment Center. Now let's talk for a second about your upcoming event, which is Tuesday, the 2nd of December. That's Giving Tuesday. What's that all about?
You know, I'll tell you what National Giving Tuesday is, and then since Susan is our expert with the event, hopefully we can give her a little time to explain that. Yeah. 3 years ago, we learned that an initiative was created nationwide, and it was a wonderful and inspiring initiative. After Black Friday and Cyber Monday, I can't remember who was the beginning of this idea, but the National Giving Tuesday was created with the intention of giving people a wonderful excuse on that particular day, so everybody would do it on the same day nationwide, to give. And it could be like people are giving that day an hour of their time to volunteer. People are giving that day a piece of clothing or a cup of soup to somebody who needs it. People can give that day a donation to their preferred, most heartfelt nonprofit. So Solace learned about that 3 years ago. And every year since then, on National Giving Tuesday, which again is the first Tuesday after Black Friday, we have done something special. Last year was an open house to thank our constituency and to invite new people to our building. And this year is going to be the event.
Susan Simons has been sitting here very quietly and as we've been talking, but tell us about this upcoming event on the 2nd of December.
We're very excited about the event this year. It's called By the Book. Now, Solace does everything BY the book.
Yeah, it's a pun on by BY and by BUY.
Exactly. And we are inviting the community to help support Solace by coming and buying a gently used book or two or three on that day. We have many books of many kinds, but not enough. We would also like to invite the community to donate more books and volunteer on that day and the day before. So we have lots of opportunities for the community to give back and help Solace out.
So how do people find out more? Where do they go to buy tickets if they want to show up on the night?
It's going to be from 2 to 8 p.m. at Solace. which is at 6601 Valentine Way. If you know where the library is in the south part of the city, it's right across from there. If there's no tickets, it's open to all.
Nice.
We would like volunteers, like I said, to help. They can call Solace or they can call me. The number to use would be 988-1951 to donate books, to donate their time. We are open to any and all suggestions.
Excellent. Maria Jose, is there anything that you would like to add before we go?
No, but I truly wanted to thank you, Mary Charlotte, because you give us these incredible opportunities, and I know you do that with so many important causes and nonprofits in town. We owe you so much, and I just wanted to thank you and thank the listeners and wish everybody a beautiful weekend.
Thank you for what you do for this community. There are so many nonprofits and there's so many groups that are doing incredible things which you might not know about or you might not make use of until the moment where you need it. And then not only is it there, but it's really quite amazing. And I have to say, the building is gorgeous. There was a moment where, I guess it was some years ago already now, that it was renovated. I went there and it was like so colorful and so beautiful. And it's like, oh my God, the healing process kind of starts the moment you walk in and see the beauty of this place.
Oh, that testimonial is exactly what we were aiming with every decision that we made in this building, because, you know, traditionally, unfortunately, people who have gone through the type of tragedies that bring them to us, we're kind of accustomed to go to places that were a lot more funky and not so good looking, just as if, you know, they believe that nonprofits cannot look good because
right.
We are poor people, right? And so what's really amazing when you think about it, and this is the job that I love the most, is to talk to people to change their ways of seeing that particular thing, is that think about it. Nonprofits are taking care in our society of the most incredible needs that affect the most people and actually can affect sometimes families and sometimes generations. And yet we have to operate with the mentality that, you know, we cannot have the same money to advertise as not as profit. We cannot have the same money to have buildings as profit. But when you think about it, it should be all the way around. People, donors, philanthropists should be always really willing to follow the lead of directors that are telling them, no, you know, in order for us to be more accessible, to be accessible to all, we actually need to have a very good advertising campaign, just like any for-profit business would, right? Or we need to be able to capture talent and people who have gone through the university and got their degrees and deserve good salaries, right? Just like the profit world would try to capture. So this building is actually that kind of dream come true. It's dignifying, it's absolutely gorgeous, and every time that somebody walks in and says what you just said, the way it feels, the healing starts there, is exactly the goal that we were aiming.
So once again, December 2nd from 2 in the afternoon till 8 in the evening. And it's right off of Airport Road, right near the Country Club. What is it, Country Club Road?
Country Club Road. And if you know where the library is, we're right across the street.
Excellent. Well, Susan Simons and Maria Jose Rodriguez Carias, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.